About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Barry Reynolds, and he'll be answering your most important questions on tactics for monster carp. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Barry a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure to sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. The broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group Inc. doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Barry Reynolds about tactics for monster carp. The Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida, in the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help recover the rare native trout, the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and is helping to prevent the introduction of harmful aquatic species to new waters with their Clean Angling Pledge. The Federation won a National Conservation Award for its efforts to continue this great work. On behalf of all fly fishers, the Federation needs to increase its membership. It needs more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects like these, and by doing so, give something back to the sport that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their fine work. And if you're already a member, go ahead and send them a donation. For more information, go to the Federation website at www.fedflyfishers.org. That's www.fedflyfishers.org. Well, before we introduce Barry, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. And on our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have 2 chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the section, the link under Barry's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Just click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a $20 gift certificate courtesy of Front Range Anglers in Boulder, Colorado. Front Range Anglers is located at www.frontrangeanglers.com. And here's how you can win that gift certificate. You can redeem that either in their store or on their website, by the way. To win, you've got to be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question is going to be about something we talked about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills at the end of the show, and be quick about it, and you might win that $20 gift certificate. Our guest tonight is Barry Reynolds. Barry Reynolds is a true master of fly fishing with over 20 years of experience guiding fly fishers to angling destinations all over the world, including Belize, Brazil, Bahamas, Alaska, and Canada, just to name a few. Barry is a certified casting instructor and master fly tier. He excels in all fields and is a pro staff member with many elite companies of the fly fishing world. Barry's love for fly fishing in the outdoors is evident in his numerous written articles and photography he has sold to magazines such as American Angler, Wild on the Fly, Warm Water Angler, and Southwest Fly Fishing. Barry has also co-authored 3 books, including Pike on the Fly, Carp on the Fly, Beyond Trout, and most recently in solo effort, Mastering Pike on the Fly. In addition to his writing skills, Barry has made more than 20 guest appearances on a variety of outdoor television and radio shows. Barry's following and continued growth in popularity with the angling public has led him to the seminar circuit during the winter months, where he travels the country and entertains and educates the public in all that fly fishing has to offer. Well, Barry, welcome back, and thanks for joining us again tonight.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me, Roger.
Well, Barry, I say welcome back because Barry's been on the show a few other times. We talked about pike, and we've talked about peacock bass, and tonight it's going to be carp. So we've got a lot to talk about, a lot of good questions, and are you ready to go, Barry?
I'm all set and ready to go whenever you are.
Okay, good. Good. Well, thanks, everybody, for submitting your questions again. As always, it's a pleasure to see them come in, and it's fun to see what interests you and what you want to learn about. So I think James Glidden in Hurricane Utah starts it out pretty good for us here. Barry says, why carp? With all the other opportunities for game fish, what makes carp so special and fun to catch?
That's a great question, and it's one I hear all the time is, you know, why would I want to go catch carp? And if you take a look at the fish itself and start to understand the fish, it answers a lot of those questions. It's a very wary fish. It's hard to approach. It's a very selective feeder, believe it or not. You know, contrary to what we see in local ponds where people go down and feed breadcrumbs and popcorn to the local duck population, which is not natural food for the carp, they're actually fairly selective feeders, and I'm sure we'll get more into that. But above anything, they're readily available. They get very big. They're hard to approach. They're extremely strong fighting fish and extremely quick. I mean, it's one of the few fish in freshwater that will take you into your backing on a regular basis. And you combine all those elements, and you've got a phenomenal fly fishing target.
Would you say it's a harder fish to catch than a trout?
Much.
Much harder. It's okay. So
much harder.
The challenge is really there, huh?
A lot of the things about carp that make them difficult and so much fun to chase around is they're one of the most intelligent fishes you can pursue with a fly rod or any kind of tackle as far as that goes. A lot of study and research has been done, and it is one of the most intelligent fish out there, and it has a lot of different biological makeups that make that fish extremely difficult to trick, if you will.
And maybe you can tell us a little bit about the history of it as well. It's not been a real common target here in the U.S. For fly fishers, but in Europe it's quite popular, I believe.
Yeah, it's the number one sport fish in Europe, and they have tournaments over there that the prize money actually exceeds $1 million in some of the tournaments. So it's a very sought-after fish over in Europe, and they get quite a bit larger over there as a rule of thumb. But as far as popularity goes, northern pike and carp are two of their top game fish in Europe. To answer your question, Roger, I guess they were actually brought over to the States in the late 1800s as a food source. When our early fish supplies started to dwindle, the government went out and looked for a fish that was hardy, that could establish populations very quickly and grow to edible size very quickly, and the carp fit all those bills. And, you know, as strange as it sounds, they were brought here as a food source.
And that was from Europe, or was it from Asia?
It was from Europe. The carp originated in Asia, and then it was transplanted further down into Europe, into Britain and Ireland and places like that before it was brought over here.
Okay, okay. Why do you think it's gotten, you know, I shouldn't say a bad name, but I think a lot of people got to go.
No, you can say that.
Go carp, you know?
It has a bad, yeah.
Why do you think that is?
Because there's so many misnomers around it. First of all, everybody believes that it's just a trash fish that feeds on nothing but basically garbage or what's left over in the water. And everybody has these preconceived notions of what they see, like I said before, at a local city park where they come up by the droves and suck, breadcrumbs and popcorn and things like that off the surface, and they don't really understand that that's not a natural food for the fish. And the other thing is that they have this uncanny ability to survive in waters that man polluted, not the fish, but man polluted, and they can survive in that water. And to me, you have to admire a creature that can adapt and survive in almost any conditions. It's not their preferred conditions. They prefer clear water and non-polluted water. I mean, that's what, they evolved and grew up in. But they've been able to adapt to what we've done to the waterways and survive and do so in numbers.
Yeah, so it's a very, very hardy fish. And, you know, it kind of has that prehistoric look as well, kind of that ancient look, you know, like a tarpon does kind of, you know.
Yeah, I tell everybody it has a face only a mother could love. And I've actually had a few people during seminars ask me if I was talking about the fish or myself, so I don't know which. Which it refers to, but in neither case, we both survived.
I'm not going to go there with you, but when you can make fun of yourself, you know, then that's up to you. But
yeah, I can do that.
Yeah, you can do that. Well, tell us, I know, you know, we were talking before the show, and you said, gosh, I just spent all summer fishing for carp, and that's kind of unusual for you, because usually you're out knocking the pike and the muskie around, so... tell us a little bit about, you know, some of the experiences you had this summer and, you know, where you fished.
Sure. I think part of that bodes well for the carp and what I think of them, because every time you go out, you learn something new from them. And I love to fish for all variety and species of fish, as you well know, but something about the carp is challenging each and every time, because one time you go out, they might be feeding on crayfish, and the next time they're feeding on damselfly nymphs or scuds or snails or, you know, just a wide variety of things. So I think that's part of it. But this summer I spent a tremendous amount of time keen into the crayfish and how they interacted with the crayfish and how they followed them around through the river system. And just getting a better grip on studying their movements based on water levels, water temperatures, and things like that. So I spent a tremendous amount of time this summer, like you said, just chasing them around. And, you know, part of my day is not fishing for them, but it's observing and watching them.
Well, where were you fishing?
Primarily on the South Platte River as it flows through downtown Denver and to the south of town and to the north of town. I covered anywhere from Oxford Avenue all the way up to 140th. Like I said, just spent a tremendous amount of time chasing and checking different areas based on water levels. And, you know, even some of the seed falls that were going on with the cottonwood seeds and things like that. But, and then we fish a lot of the local ponds around town as well. As you know, most lakes and ponds now have some carp in them, and some have large populations of big fish in them. And anytime I can go out and chase a 30-pound fish around on a fly rod, you usually find me taking advantage of that opportunity.
Well, how big a fish did you get this summer? What was your
The biggest fish I landed this summer was 36 pounds, 8 ounces.
Wow. Oh, that's a lot of fish.
That's a lot of fish. But we're seeing fish, Roger, now that are well in excess of 40 pounds almost every time we go out. And it was my goal was this summer was to try and get one of those 40-plus pound fish, and we managed to hook a few, but landing them is a different story.
Well, we'll have to talk about that because that involves equipment and technique and so forth. Well, you did a little bit of both. You said you were fishing the Platte River, which is, you know, a river, obviously, and
right.
And some ponds. So you're doing some still water fishing for them as well.
Absolutely. I love to chase them on lakes as well.
Yeah, and I understand that a lot of guys, you know, talk about carp as the freshwater bonefish of, you know, as far as sight fishing and fishing in the flats. I know they do that up in Wyoming quite a bit, in the flats.
Yeah, a lot of similarities between carp and how we would chase bonefish and redfish. Both fish could be crossed over, and I highly suggest and recommend to people that are getting ready to go do a saltwater trip that they warm up on carp first. And in many cases, they find the carp a lot more difficult than they found the bonefish and the redfish. So,
yeah, good training and practice. Well, tell us a little bit about the equipment you're using. You know, what rod length and weight are you using? Because, you know, a 36 or 40-pound fish is a lot of fish on a rod.
Yeah, and believe it or not, I usually fish with a 6 weight. A lot of the guys I fish with will fish a 7 or an 8 weight, but I've kind of settled into a 6 weight. It's a more than enough rod to handle these fish in most situations. You get into a bigger lake, then I'll switch over and use, like I said, a 7 or an 8 weight rod, but most scenarios I can handle these fish with a 6 weight. I rarely fish anything but a floating line. Because I am typically sight fishing these fish in fairly shallow water, usually less than about 4 foot of water. And you know, a sink tip or a full sinking line is not necessary under those conditions. And to be quite honest with you, if I had to chase them in deeper water, I'd probably fish for something else.
Hmm. Wouldn't be as fun, huh?
Not as fun. That's part of the allure, you know, is to chase them when you can see them and see how they react to your fly and how they react to your retrieve and whatnot. As far as the leaders go, I typically am using a 9-foot leader in either a 3X or a 4X.
3 or 4X tippet?
Uh-huh. So, you know, roughly about 8-pound test, the equivalent of about 8-pound test on these fish. But if you get them in real...
leader shy, then, I was going to say.
Well, I was just going to say, if you get them in super skinny water, they can get a bit touchy sometimes with leaders. It depends how much pressure's been on them, which I know sounds kind of silly. You know, probably 5 or 6 years ago, you'd said pressure on carp and nobody would have believed it, but a lot more people are getting out there chasing them around and fishing for them. And areas where they've been fished over harder, we're having to go down and, you know, fish 4X or even 5X, so... somewhere in that 4.5 to 6 pound range and tip it.
When you said before, when you go out in lakes, sometimes you'll fish with a 7 weight or 8 weight. Is that mainly for wind, distance, and size of flies, or what is your reason for larger?
To be able to fight and handle the fish better and put more pressure on them with a little bit more stout rod. Because if you've got a sizable lake where these fish can get out and run and take off, you want to be able to have the backbone in the rod and put the heat on the fish and turn them. And, you know, if they get out in the deeper water and start heading for a tree, you want to be able to put the brakes on and turn them when you need to. Because they have an uncanny ability to find every nook, cranny, tree, branch, rock, or anything else that they can wrap the line around and break you off.
I suppose a lot of the flats and the reservoirs and so forth involve a lot of trees and so and whatnot.
There's a couple that I swear to God, every fish in that lake knows where the tree is, and as soon as you hook them, that's what they head for. So,
well, let's take a quick break here, Barry, and then when we come back, we'll start digging into food and flies and see what these critters eat, and that'll help us to catch them, I hope.
That sounds great.
Okay. Royal Gorge Anglers is a full-service fly shop on the Arkansas River in Canyon City, Colorado. They provide both walk wade and float fishing guide service on the Arkansas, South Platte, and several private high country ranches. They specialize in fly fishing education and work to assure that everyone taking a trip leaves being a better fly fisher. For the best service and the most fun in the Southern Rockies, visit the folks at Royal Gorge Anglers, the gateway to Southern Colorado. Located conveniently on US 50, only 45 minutes from Colorado Springs. For more information, visit their website at www.royalgorgeanglers.com. That's www.royalgorgeanglers.com. Or call them at 888-994-6743. That's 888-994-6743. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Barry Reynolds about tactics for monster carp. If you'd like to ask Barry a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Barry, before we jump into the food and flies, tell us a bit about what you've been up to in the fly fishing world since we last talked. You've been doing some television stuff.
We did some TV stuff for a while there, and we've also, just last year we released a new DVD called Urban Warfare, and it focuses basically on exactly what we're talking about and trying to show people how much fun going out and chasing carp around on a fly rod can be and how readily available they are, you know, in times of when the gas prices were so high and people are, you know, budget-oriented more than ever now, we still have great fishing opportunities close to home. And so we really tried to share with everybody and capture what's available, you know, nearby and not having to travel real far to do it. And they can still go out and enjoy their favorite sport, get better at it, and learn a few things along the way. So that's what we tried to do with Urban Warfare. And currently we're working on another project that's called Pursuit, and it's a little bit of fly fishing all over the world. It goes from fishing, you know, local ponds and creeks for carp and smallmouth and largemouth bass to chasing peacock down in the Amazon jungle. So we've got a little bit of everything in that DVD, and we hope to have that out sometime midsummer next year.
Okay, okay. Now, I know you're working on your website, but why don't you give your website address anyway? And you told me what, it could probably be another couple, 3 weeks before it's ready, but...
Yeah, absolutely. We're hoping to have it ready in the next 2 weeks. We're going to have lots of new video clips and short movies up and a place for people to interact and ask questions and email me back and forth. But the website is www.barryreynoldsflyfishing.com, and I'd like to take this opportunity to apologize to everybody out there that's been looking for it, that has sent me personal emails and wanted to know what was going on. We just didn't time it very well when we pulled down the old site, and we're getting ready to launch the new site. So hopefully here in the next 2 weeks we'll have that up, and I'll get a chance to catch up with everybody then.
Great, great. And in the meantime, where can folks get your DVDs? Is there a source?
Most of the local fly shops are starting to carry it, or either have it in their shop, or they have the ability to order it in, or they can get on the computer and get online and type in Urban Warfare and Barry Reynolds, and it should direct them to where they can get it. And we will have a store feature on our website once it does relaunch, and they'll be able to order it direct from us as well.
Okay, great, great. Terrific. Okay, well, let's get dig back into our questions here. Talk about food and flies. You'd mentioned a few food sources here a few minutes ago, but what all do they eat? And you said they're kind of finicky about what they eat. So what are they eating, and how do we represent those food sources?
Yeah, this, and again, another great question. So much of it is dependent upon the area of the country you live in, but they do feed upon a wide variety of things, and at certain times they can get real selective on very select items. You know, you could have cottonwood seed falling, and they really keyed into that, and they won't feed on anything else. During the springtime, just as you're coming out of the cold time of year into the spring, they'll key into the midges. So, again, just a huge and very diverse diet, which is part of what makes them so challenging, is they do take advantage of just about everything in the food chain, from vegetation all the way up to, you know, adult damselflies, and even we've seen them busting through schools of bait fish. But depending on the water that they're fishing, primarily one of their two big food items that I found that they feed on a regular and consistent base is crayfish and then aquatic worms. And those are two of their bigger dietary foods that they'll feed upon on a consistent basis. And, you know, based off of that, I can usually go out and get them to take a crayfish pattern on a fairly regular basis.
Interesting. And aquatic worms, what do they look like?
Well, like a San Juan worm.
About like a San Juan. Okay, okay.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mudworms, bloodworms, however you want to call them, they feed on them very heavily, and the crayfish. But when we think about crayfish, you need to think about small, immature crayfish. So the small, typically an inch and a half would be a big crayfish for them. They can eat bigger, and I found them eating bigger ones, but as a rule of thumb, you know, about an inch, inch and a half on those crayfish.
Okay.
But they eat those like candy.
Oh, wow, wow. I just got a message here on the Internet that my audio wasn't very loud. Bill, I know you sent me that message. I appreciate that. Is my audio better now? I've adjusted the volume. Give me some feedback if you can. I'd appreciate it. And thanks for letting me know. Bart Lombardo in New Jersey wants to know, you know, what are your top fly patterns for carp? And, well, he says stillwaters, but let's just talk about in general. We have several questions about, you know, favorite patterns. What are some of the patterns that you're liking nowadays?
My top producing fly for carp to date still remains the Clouser swimming nymph, which Bob Clouser designed to imitate the big mayflies back east for smallmouth. We've taken it and we've adjusted the colors accordingly to more closely mimic the crayfish and rusty browns, and done very, very well with it. I think the key, Roger, that people need to be aware of with their fly patterns is being able to present it down to the fish where they're feeding. So we'll take one pattern, but we'll tie it four different ways as far as weight goes, so we can cover the water from top to bottom, and from super skinny water to you know, the deeper water, which again is only about 4 foot deep. But being able to get the fly in front of the fish and get it down to them in a timely manner is important, but also being able to present that fly close enough to the carp without spooking it and getting it down to them. So we'll take one pattern and we'll type in four or five different weighted versions to be able to present it.
Okay, and it sounds like you're weighting the fly rather than weighting the using weights. Is that the preferable method for you?
Absolutely. I much prefer to weight the fly. You know, I'll use, like on my Clouser swimming nymphs, I'll use a .020 lead wire wrap, and I'll wrap you know, anywhere a light weight on that would be like 8 wraps of that around the hook shank before I tied the fly. If we're dealing in moving water and I need to get the fly down quicker, I might go as many as 15 to 18 wraps. So we'll play with the weight depending on the situation and the water levels that we're having to deal with at that point in time. And it's obviously it's going to be different for people all over the country on the waters that they're trying to fish. But typically you're going to find on my flies anywhere from 8 to 12, 14 wraps of that wire.
Okay. Well, we did get a question on the Internet here. Kenny Gilman in Clovis, California asks, what of my favorite trout flies will work if I decide to try for carp? And you just answered that with one of the Gauzer Swimming Nymph is one of them. Are there other ones that are easily transitioned over to carp from trout?
Absolutely. They any of the hare's ear nymphs, squirrel nymphs, halfbacks, any of your trout flies in general will work. It just, again, you got to really pay attention to their environment and find out what they're feeding on and what's available within that system. But there's times a year, particularly again in the springtime, where we're getting them on midges and fishing down to size 18s for them. So, yeah, all your trout flies will work. Again, it's just being able to get the fly in front of the fish at the depth that they're feeding.
Do they seem to be hatch sensitive? In other words, you know, emerging nymphs and so forth, are they sensitive just like a trout to that?
At times they can be, if that's what's most available. We're talking about experiences I had this summer, and one of them was I was down on the Platte, and of all things, a small mayfly hatch came off, and that's all they were feeding on were the emergers. They would not touch anything else, but to sit there and see 20 and 25-pound carp just below the surface feeding on emergers was pretty awesome sight to see. So they'll key into bait fish when bait fish is readily available. I've seen them bust through schools of bait fish much like you'd see stripers do.
And that I've also expect, but yeah.
It's pretty awesome. And then another thing you'll see them do is you'll see them strip leaves off trees when you get the overhanging tree branches. So again, just a wide variety of things. They'll key into damsel flies, mayflies, leeches, again, just a very, very diverse diet, which, like I said, it brings a whole new meaning to matching the hatch, especially when they start stripping leaves off trees.
Yeah, it makes you wonder. No wonder they've been living for thousands of years, you know. But yet they must, you said they're smart, so they're sensitive to the artificial versus the real thing, whether it be leaves or an emerging nymph.
Yeah, and they have a very acute sensory organs, their sense of smell, their sense of taste, their hearing. All that is very, very highly developed in this fish. And, you know, it's very important that we pay attention to those things as well. You know, you can't go and tie a fly on that you just handled a gasoline can with. They will smell that and they will sense that. And they'll refuse it. So one of the things, one of the little tips I have since we're talking about flies is the first thing I do with my fly is I'll take it and rub it in the mud before I start casting it out and putting it in front of fish. Because to get all the scent off your hands because they have a very acute sense of smell.
Interesting. And again, in comparison, more so than trout, you'd say.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at the carp and you look, it has those barbels, that works not only with their sense of smell but with their sense of taste. They have taste buds along each side on their lateral line it's tied into, and also in the pectoral and pelvic fins they have taste buds, believe it or not. So they can sit there and pick out very minute smells in the water and determine whether that is something they should investigate further or ignore it.
We've got a couple of questions. See, one that just came in on the Internet, and then a couple that came in earlier in the week. Doug McLean in Calgary, Alberta, asks about patterns and tactics for grass carp. We've got another one that came in on the Internet. Vic in Oklahoma, would you talk a bit about fishing in ponds for carp that just feed on grass and vegetation? You want to talk about a couple of different kinds of carp that we might find and differences in their feeding habits?
Sure. Basically, you got two types of carp that we target fly fishing, you have the common carp, which comes in different shapes and sizes. The common carp can also, you'll find it in a scaleless pattern, which is called a leather carp, but it's still a regular carp. You also have mirror carp, which again is just a different scaling pattern. It's got oversized scales that are very reflective, and again, it's just the common carp. The grass carp, or white and moor, is actually, it's fairly far down the family tree if you went in and looked at the family origins with carp, but they were mostly thought of as a vegetarian, and in most lakes that's why they were put in there, was to help reduce the vegetation within a given body of water. But I can tell you there was a fishing contest that was held here in Colorado about 9 or 10 years ago. The top three fish in that tournament were all three grass carp. One was caught on a spoon, the other was caught on a spinnerbait, and one was caught on a crankbait. And the last time I checked, not one of those imitated any kind of vegetation whatsoever.
I guess not.
So here again is a fish that, while its primary forage is vegetation, it will make do with what's available also. But when I target grass carp, or when grass carp are, you know, the primary carp that's available within a given body of water, I am usually throwing an all-white woolly booger or an all-olive woolly booger. And again, we vary the weight because sometimes they'll be feeding on it up near the surface or on the surface, and sometimes they, once the wind, or if you get a little bit of chop on the lake, that vegetation and those seeds will start to settle down through the water column, and I've seen them actually feeding out in open water down 3, 4, 5, 6 feet, so we'll allow the booger to drop down through that water column to where the fish are feeding.
So is there a way to tell? I mean, for instance, there's a question here from Steve in Long Island, and he says, I've got koi that are almost 3 feet long, 20 pounds in my bass pond. They'd be caught on flies, and what would you use? I suppose a lot of people can go look at their farm ponds or look in any local lake, and they're going to be looking at carp. How do they know whether it's a grass carp or regular carp? Is there any way to tell from looking?
The body shape is different. The coloration is different. The grass carp tend to be a little longer, where common carp tend to be a bit squattier and thicker bodied in proportions. The other thing is the white amur or the grass carp is a silverish white in coloration, where the common carp is gold or bronze with usually reddish orange tail and fins on them. The other thing is you don't find the, if you were able to catch one and see it up close, you would see that the barbels that the common carp are different than what you would find on the grass carp. The grass carp will primarily feed on vegetation. That's what, they tend to key into. So if you were going to target them specifically, you would have to look at the vegetation that's available and if there is any seed falls or leaves or things like that that's available that's falling into the lake that they're taking advantage of. Try and match, again, crudely, match the hatch based off of that. But I've also taken grass carp on the clouser swimming nymph. I've taken them on regular clousers when we're fishing bass ponds. So they will hit a wide variety of things also.
Well, Steve's question was about his koi. Koi, a type of carp, or?
Yeah, they're specially bred. They're ornamental type fish that are usually put in people's ponds. And again, primarily vegetation and algae feeders, but a lot of the local ponds around here, people have taken their goldfish and their koi down there and let them go in these ponds. And again, we catch them from time to time, and we've taken them on, again, the standard patterns that I usually throw, a clouser swimming nymph, Egan's headstand, but I got one on earlier this year. So you will catch them on a wide variety of things also.
Well, we did, you just mentioned that, and we have Ariel Levin in Los Angeles. He says, I love fishing for urban carp, and I see the spin fishermen catching large amounts with breads of all kinds. I'm looking for an excellent fly. I already use the Egan's headstand, which you just mentioned, and the usual suspect, the glowworm-style fly. And then he asked for other suggestions, which you've been kindly handing out. Have you worked with the glowworm? Has that been something you use?
I have not, and I guess I'd have to get a little bit of clarification. I would assume it's something along the lines of what we talked about earlier with the San Juan worm. Maybe it's tied with a little bit different material, but like I said, they do spend a great deal of time feeding on aquatic worms like bloodworms and those things. As far as other suggestions, I mean, he's using some pretty good patterns that that tend to produce in most locations. Again, the thing I'd recommend is to get out there, turn some rocks over, you know, run a seine net or something through the mud and see what's available, what else is available for them to be feeding upon, and be aware certain times of the year they might switch over and feed on damselflies or dragonfly nymphs if they're, you know, at a time when they're real active. You just can't get locked into fishing one pattern or one thing that's produced time and time before, because it changes every time you go out there. And why, you know, I can usually go out and catch one on a clouser swimming nymph, it might not be the most productive fly on that given day. There's usually a fly that might produce better at a certain time of year because there's something that's more abundant. We have freshwater clams in the South Platte, for example, and they will key into those at certain times and feed on the freshwater clams.
Wow. So really, like any other fish, you need to study and see what's going on that day. And if it's moving and living, they're probably eating it in one way, shape, or form.
Absolutely. I mean, and you make a great point. It's not a fish that you can just go out and half-heartedly chase around and expect to have success with, and certainly not have consistent success with. My first experience with carp on the fly was I was actually out trout fishing during a damselfly hatch, and I kept seeing all these fish taking emergers, and what we assumed were trout dimples were actually pods of carp feeding on the damsels. And that was about 20 years ago when we really first started to think about targeting them and coming up and developing ways to chase them and take them on a consistent basis. But you do have to learn and study the fish and its environment. And, you know, like I said, every part of the country is different. Every environment's different, from fishing them in a gravel pit pond where their primary food might be crayfish, or more than likely is crayfish, to fishing them in a real muddy pond where it could be the aquatic worms are their primary forage.
Right.
But
right.
It, like you said, Roger, it's just like chasing any other fish, and it's just more with how selective and how smart these fish can be. So it's a puzzle every time you go out there that you've got to decipher and work through as you fish for them throughout the course of the day. And very rarely do we go out and we start out successful right away. It's usually an evolution of trial and error, and we know primarily what they're feeding on, but that doesn't guarantee that's what they're feeding on that day. So that's, again, part of the allure and fun of going out and chasing these fish around, is trying to solve that puzzle each time you go out.
Well, with that, Barry, we'll take another break, and when we return, we'll talk more with Barry Reynolds about tactics for monster carp. Keeney's Fly Shop in Sacramento, California features classes on all aspects of fly fishing. They have an extensive inventory and fly tying department, and a friendly, experienced staff whose primary goal is your complete satisfaction. Among their many services, one can book private waters or take advantage of their international travel service. Visit their extensive website at www.keeney.com, that's K-I-E-N-E.com, or call them at 1-800-400-0359, that's 800-400-0359. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Barry Reynolds about tactics for monster carp. If you'd like to ask Barry a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use our Q&A text box there to send us a question. Receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Barry, we've got another question here, which is Martin Coleman, Lawrence, Kansas. He says, when working a foam line from wind on a lake, what are the carp eating? Is it insects caught up in the foam or a food source below it? What would be some good flies for attracting carp in this situation?
Well, I guess the first thing, you know, again, you're going to have to determine what's available. And chances are they are feeding on insects right in the foam. So first thing we need to do is observe, are they feeding on the surface or just below the surface? If they're feeding on the surface, that's what we refer to as clooping carp. So you'll see them and their mouths are up out of the water. They're not that hard to figure out if they're feeding on the surface at that point. And if that's the case, then it's insects, more than likely, you know, some midges or mayflies that are washed up in that foam line that they're coming up and feeding on. If they're feeding down below, it could be, again, a wide variety of things that are getting washed back down through the water column from the wind churning the lake up. It could be anything from the emergers to dead insects, such as midges and whatnot, being washed down through the column. And it could be decaying vegetation that's gotten torn loose and floating along in there. So, again, observation and actually, you know, the ability to check and look through that and see what's in there and available that they're feeding upon.
Another question, Dave in Texas says, Barry, this summer I was carp fishing on a lake in northern Texas, and I noticed carp would leave baseball-sized depressions in the bottom of the lake. I was using a crawdad fly and not having any success. Any suggestions on what they were feeding on or maybe how he was fishing?
First two thoughts come is my first thought would be they might have been on a bed of aquatic worms or the blood worms, so they may have been onto the worms in that case. The second thing would be is more times than not when you're seeing those kind of things, it's crayfish or nymphs that they were digging and rooting through the mud for. One of the suggestions that I have for the listeners is try and stay away from flies that have a lot of flash in them. If there's any flash, and to give you an idea, Roger, what I'm talking about, I can take a clouser swimming nymph that many times is tied with a few strands of flashaboo in the tail and put that fly in front of a carp, and as soon as that fly gets in front of them, they see that flash and they spook off of it. I can sit there and pull the flash out, represent the fly, and have them eat it, no questions asked. So they're very sensitive to bright things, particularly in clear water situations. The other thing could be the color of the fly. Again, I do really well with patterns that are tied in browns, rusty brown, or even a burnt orange color, particularly when it comes to the crayfish as they're molding. So my first two suggestions would be that. The other would be to vary the weight that we're presenting the fly to them with. If there's too much weight, the splash alone could be spooking them, and the fly itself may be too big or too small. We had them on a crayfish bite earlier this year, and we were throwing a size number 6 long-shanked clouser swimming nymph, and the fish would seem interested, but they wouldn't eat it, but I immediately went down to an Egan's headstand, which is much smaller, and the fish immediately started taking the fly. So those would be my immediate thoughts and suggestions on that situation.
Tell us a bit how you, specifically how you fish your crayfish. Is there a difference between how you fish them in a river as opposed to a still water?
No, how I approach the fish is going to be different. How I fish the fly itself will be pretty much the same, because even in river situations, I'm looking for backwater areas or very skinny water that they're up into. So I don't have to deal with a ton of current most of the time in most of my situations when I'm fishing them in rivers. The one thing is what I'm looking for in a lake or a pond is an area or a shallow water area that these fish can come up and root around and tail and feed in. And sometimes, you know, I know there was a couple questions that referred to deeper shorelines where there weren't really any flats. Those carp will come right up to the edge of the shoreline and root around and feed to the point where they're almost completely out of the water. It's like they're trying to evolve and walk on land. So they'll get up in super skinny water even when there's no skinny water available. And when I say that, I mean I'm talking about the immediate shoreline around those lakes. So they'll come up into that. But what I typically like to do, when possible, is I like to cast beyond the fish and pull the fly back to the fish and allow it to fall in front of it in a natural way. Carp typically won't move real far for a fly unless they're super aggressive, which, you know, enjoy those days while you get them, because that's not too often. But I like to quarter my cast, cast beyond the fish so it doesn't spook the fish, and cast past the fish and then pull the fly, again, if you will, at a 45-degree angle, back towards the fish. And then once I get it about 6, 7, 8 inches out in front of the fish where the fish can now see the fly, I'll stop my retrieval, allow the fly to fall. And usually once that fly falls, the fish will react one way or another, usually positively or negatively. And then once that fish sees it and moves towards it to investigate, I'll give it a real slow strip. I think that in most situations when you're in super skinny water or super clear water situations, the more subtle you can be with your retrieves and your presentations, the more successful you're going to be. So you don't want to do anything aggressive with super fast strips or things like that that will alarm or spook the fish and blow it out of an area like that. So again, try and sneak up on the fish with your presentation and quarter your cast past the fish, bring the fly back in front of it, let it fall, and sit there for a second. Let the carp move a little bit and then twitch it once or twice, and usually they'll move right over and check it out. And hopefully they'll suck it in.
We've got a couple of questions here. Don Daly in Clarksville, Tennessee asks, and we have a couple others here about similar things. Do you do any blind casting for carp, or are you always sight casting for them?
No, it's, again, a great question. We do some blind casting, and I'll give you those scenarios. Obviously, the reason that I enjoy chasing carp so much is the sight fishing aspect of it. Whenever that's available, that's what I want to do. But there are times it just doesn't work. You get a super cloudy day, or you get a little wind and chop on the water, and sight fishing is just not a possibility. When that happens and I'm dead set on fishing for carp, I will blind cast. And what I do then is I seek out the areas where I know these fish frequent and move up onto. So I look for those flats that they move up onto to feed upon, and I will blind cast and fang cast those areas. Another time I'll blind cast is when there's a big muddied area where I know carp are either in there or been in there, feeding and rooting around. And when I find those areas, again, I will sit there and thoroughly fish those and do so by blind casting through. But in those situations, again, I can't overemphasize the importance of a very slow retrieve and also keeping in constant contact with the fly line and not allowing there to be any slack in your leader or your fly line, because the takes on these fish are so subtle and so delicate that if you don't keep a tight line, you're never going to feel the fact that that fish picked the fly up, checked it out, and decided it wasn't what it wanted, and spit it back out. I like to tease people. I tell them they can pick a fly up and count their thread wraps and spit it back out before they knew what happened.
Sure, Barry.
And there's a lot of truth to that. They will pick that fly up, mouth it, and spit it back out before you knew what happened if you don't keep a tight leader. And that's the point.
I hope you have this claim documented on film about the counting of the thread wraps.
Yeah, I do.
No. We got a couple of questions here. Bill in Evans, Georgia, and another Bill in Brooklyn, New York. And they both are asking questions about fishing for carp in muddy or stained, you know, water, whether it be lakes, ponds, or rivers or whatever. And you just started to address that, you know, when you had some chop on the water. Maybe you can fill them in a bit more on tactics when, you know, when you can't sight fish for them. And incidentally, Bill Henry in Brooklyn says, we have lots of 30-pound carp in New York City parks. So you can fly fish for carp anywhere, even in New York City, huh?
Absolutely. I'll let them know I'm on my way. The question as far as, you know, fishing real dirty or stained muddy water that you, where you just can't see the fish. In most of those cases, they're going to, if you can find the flats or identify the areas that these fish will move up to feed upon. Again, I'll give you an example. Is one of the lakes or ponds that I like to fish is basically chocolate browns. It looks like a bad cup of coffee with cream in it. And the sight fishing, you would think, would be null and void. But what we did is we identified a couple areas where the fish were coming up in water that was shallow enough that even when they dropped their nose to feed, their tails, while they wouldn't come up above the surface, they would come close enough to the surface that we could still pick their tails out, even in super dirty water that you otherwise wouldn't be able to see anything in. So learning to spot these fish, even in dirty water, will be huge in their ability to present a fly to them and ultimately have success with them. But you can find them in those situations and still identify fish down there. The other way you can do it is typically when they're in a situation where they're rooting around and stirring up the bottom, they're throwing up mud clouds. And in this lake, like I said, it's kind of a whitish brown tint to the water. And when they're rooting around, it's a dark brown cloud that's coming up from the bottom. So we walk around this lake until we start seeing those dark brown clouds, and then we know that there are carp down there rooting around and feeding.
That's a good sign, yeah.
Yeah, and in most cases I say that. The last time I went out and did that, I threw to a mudding cloud like that. I pulled in about a 50-pound snapping turtle instead of a carp, so.
Oh, my God. Surprise, surprise.
Yeah, and my buddy wanted to know if I was going to take the fly out, and I said, no, he can keep it for a souvenir.
But, yeah, I would let him, yeah.
But, no, you even in those situations, you can still tell if there's fish around. Either look for, because most times the carp has a orangish red, brightly colored tail, and when they're in there actively feeding, they're moving slow enough and they're dropping their head and raising their tail to a point where you'll still be able to see that tail near the surface, or you're going to see water that is discolored differently than the other dirty water that they're fishing in. And they should be able to pick out carp in those situations or areas that the carp are actively in feeding.
We have a question that kind of takes off on that. Eldon's in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. And he has a, kind of a, several parts to his question. He wants to know, is there anything about season or time of day? And then he extends that and asks about water temperature or cloud cover. Can you kind of address those things as to whether they make a difference in carp or in their feeding habits?
Yeah, everybody's got great questions. I mean, that's a wonderful question. I find the carp most approachable early in the morning and late in the evenings from a standpoint of them being willing to come up. So low light periods where they'll come up on the flats and they're not quite as skittish and not quite as spooky and therefore easier to approach. The downfall is they're a lot harder to spot at that point, so they're a lot harder to see. They're most easiest to see during the high sun, and obviously a flat, calm day makes it all that much better, but they're extremely hard to approach, and they're very spooky at that point. But I like to get to my carp spots first thing and observe and see what they're doing if they're starting to move up on the flats first thing in the morning. And I typically will fish them, Roger, till about 10 or 11 o'clock, and then they'll start to pull back and drift off the flats and start spending more time over deeper water. Now, they'll still feed. They're just usually not typically up in water that's as skinny, particularly in those conditions where it's you got a high sun. The last cloudy day I went out, the fish were up on the flats all day long, but just very difficult to spot. Once you could spot them, they were easy to approach, easy to put the fly in front of, and fed quite well. But again, they can be very, very difficult. So people need to really slow down in those situations and approach with care and with caution, because they once you spook one, you usually spook the whole herd of them out of there, and it'll take them a while to settle back down. So I love first light, first thing in the morning.
Okay. What about seasonal? Does the season have anything to do with their habits?
Yeah, typically the best skinny water flats style fishing we find are during your summer months. So usually starting sometime in mid to late April, we'll start to get a real good bite in skinny water, and it will stay consistent. I was just out this past weekend, and we had fish up on the flats actually feeding until the water temperatures drop back down through the 50s and into the 40s, and then they tend to winter up during the cold months, so they'll pot up in big numbers and usually drop into the deeper holes and spend very little time on the flats. It's not to say that you can't have a warm day in the middle of the winter and go out there and find them to pull up on flats. Actually, I had one day 2 years ago, it was February, the air temperature was in the teens, and we were picking up fish on a flat tailing during a snowstorm. So they're fairly active. They do feed throughout the winter time. It's just, it's a bit spotty, and the one thing I will tell you is the fight that we so much enjoy from them when the water temperatures are warmer and the knuckle-busting runs that they can put you through, they tend to fight more like a wet sock during the winter months.
Well, it's interesting you say that because one of my friends was in the business of putting in koi ponds, you know, in people's backyards and so forth. And they made those ponds deep enough so that those koi could just lay on the bottom. And that's basically what they did all winter, almost in a hibernation state. They'd even get ice over the top, and the koi just lay on the bottom there. And I don't even know if they fed them or anything during the winter months, but they were pretty lethargic.
And that's typically what we find here during the winter months is there are days we can go out and chase them around, particularly if you've had a 3 or 4 day stretch where you've had decent weather. It doesn't have to be, you know, in the 60s or 70s. You could have a few days of 40 or 50 degree weather, and you'll find some activity any place, particularly on river systems where you get warm water discharges. You also find them to remain fairly active through the winter months. But as a rule of thumb, it gets pretty spotty for a fish that's already hard enough to approach on a regular basis when everything's right to go around and chase in the wintertime.
Yeah. Well, Barry, we need to take another break. But when we come back, we'll talk with you more about tactics for monster carp. Have you ever dreamed about the classic actions of bamboo fly rods? Did you know that it's possible for you to make your own bamboo rods? Well, with the help of Power Fibers online magazine, you can do just that. Power Fibers magazine is dedicated to making bamboo fly rods and telling the stories about bamboo through the ages. From rod making techniques to stories about their fishing bamboo rods to rod maker profiles to classic tapers, Power Fibers has it all. Visit our website at www.powerfibers.com. That's www.powerfibers.com. We're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Barry Reynolds about tactics for monster carp. If you'd like to ask Barry a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Barry, we had one question here, kind of bouncing around on you, but Joe in New York had asked about fall-wintertime carp season, and you just answered that for him. But he had another question. He says he fishes a man-made lake with little shallow water. I've never seen carp schooling or finning in the shallows like show in the magazine articles, but they do jump and splash out in the deeper water, so I know they are there. What tactics can I use to find these fish when I can't see them out in open water like that?
Again,
that's a tough one.
The first thing I would do is walk the lake. I mean, you know, depending obviously on the size of the lake, but if it's a lake that I could dissect from shore, I would walk the shoreline. And again, I would focus early in the morning and late in the evenings and see if these fish aren't coming up and taking advantage of even just the slightest bit of shallow water along the immediate shoreline. That being said,
what time of day is a factor?
Yeah, absolutely, especially in a case where they don't have those flats or any skinny water to come up in and root around in. What I have found, because I fish a couple places that are similar to that, they're old gravel pit ponds, and they have very little shallow water access. But what I did find with those ponds is that these fish, at first thing in the morning when I first got there, they were up right along the shoreline. And they were feeding and rooting just like the carp in lakes where they'd had those flats. But very spooky, very hard to approach, and it didn't take they might only be there for 30 seconds, Roger, rooting around, and then they drop back off into the deeper water.
So, but that makes sense from what you were saying, you know, when they're moving into the flats. So go early and go late and see if they aren't in those shallow areas. That's very good tip, very good tip. I'm going to ask this question anyway, but I think I know the answer, knowing you. Scott in California, he says, do you ever chum for carp and then throw a similar patter, for example, bread or corn, and then throw a bread corn fly?
That's cheating.
That's what I knew you'd say. But I had to ask it. There was another question about somebody else chumming. So I think they maybe it's this, Barry. Maybe they feel they have to chum because they are difficult to catch.
Absolutely, and I've seen people do it. I know the technique, and you know, it's And I'm not going to say good, bad, or indifferent about it. What I will say is this, it's not necessary. You don't need to do that. If you will study the fish and study the habitat that's available to them and to you to fish, and learn what's available as far as what food sources are available and when they're taking advantage of them, you can go in there and match the hatch effectively and do it without sinning or baiting these fish. And I know guys that go out and bait them in and do that. But to me, it kind of takes the fun out of the sport of it, and that's to go out and match wits with a fish. And that is to figure out what it is they're feeding on, how I need to present the fly to them, how I need to retrieve the fly to elicit a response from that fish. And, you know, it's part of the fly fishing puzzle, and that is, you know, figuring out what they're feeding on, when they're feeding on, and what kind of presentation and retrieve it takes to get a response. And I've never baited carp in or thrown corn flies at them or done any of those things. I went out and I looked at what do these fish eat. And again, corn is not on their regular diet, at least as far as I know. It's not a natural food for them. So go out, study the fish, learn their environment, learn what food's available, and then apply that to your fly fishing, and you can go out and catch fish on a consistent basis. There's still days I go out and don't catch fish, and trust me, I'd love to chum them up, but I'm there's days
what
I
see you, Barry.
Yeah, and I would never hear the end of it, trust me.
Yeah, right.
But that's part of the challenge, and that's part of the draw for me is I don't always win. Sometimes I go out and the fish wins. But I certainly learn something and take something away from a day like that and apply it the next time I go back out and try and, you know, show a better showing for myself. Because I figured the carp won that one, but they're not going to win the next one. But like I said, through research and observation and understanding their environment and what foods are available to them, you can figure it out, and it's not necessary. You can be highly successful with these fish by doing those things.
Now, Dane in Ohio asks, he says, it seems to me that carp cruise more than smallmouth bass and trout in slow-moving rivers. Is this consistent with your experience? And maybe he's talking about the movement into the shallows. Is that what he's talking about, do you think?
I think what he's talking is the fact that they just don't spend a lot of time in one area. Again, they're a very wary and skittish fish, so they'll move up onto a flat, feed, move through it, and, you know, you could be on a flat on one section of the river and sit there and see 15, 20 fish up there, and within a minute or two, every one of them is gone. So they don't, or roost in, I guess is a better word, roost in a certain area for very long. They tend to mill around quite a bit. So, no, I completely agree with what he's saying, and that's my own observations, is these fish move around a tremendous amount. But I see it in lakes and in rivers alike. It's not just related to rivers. I see them do the same thing in lakes and ponds where they'll move through an area, they'll disappear, and, you know, another 20 minutes or half an hour goes by, and here they come again. Another wave of them will move up on the flat and feed, or move through an area and feed, and then they'll keep on going. Carp tend to cruise quite a bit, so and it
yeah, more than it sounds like trout, which will tend to hold in a pocket or a current or whatever, and only
right.
If they have to.
Well, and
yeah.
It's just like bonefish. When you get on a bonefish flat, they don't sit there all day long. These fish move up, they're feeding, they're moving as they feed, and then they'll drop back off and disappear, and then, you know, again, 20 minutes, a half an hour later, here comes another group of them in there. So that's very typical behavior.
Okay, we've got a couple of questions about places to fish and so forth. Denny in Breckenridge, Colorado says, is there a prime time, and you already, I think, answered this, prime time for carp on the Front Range of Colorado, but what waters do you suggest? Are there any particular lakes, reservoirs, other rivers other than the Platte that you suggest for carp?
Well, there's literally hundreds of ponds and local ponds that are all full of fish, but if you're talking about lake specific, you Chatfield Reservoir's got a good population of big carp, and there's some great flats that they'll come into there. There's also, a half a dozen ponds around the immediate area there that are full of carp as well. Clear water situations in those lakes are very, very skittish fish, hard to approach, but they're very large, 18 to 22 pounds would be an average fish in some of these areas. So they're worth the effort, but those are all good areas. Cherry Creek Reservoir is full of big carp. There's 20 to 40 pound fish out there. Union, Lone Tree, all those Front Range lakes. Most of the lakes along the Front Range are packed full of carp. Jackson Reservoir is another good lake where they'll come up in the flooded rush and debris along the shoreline, where you'll see lots and lots of tailing carp and have great shots at them.
Are most of those lakes, are you fishing from the shore and waiting, or are you in a boat and chasing them?
No, more times than not, I'm fishing the shoreline for them. And we do fish from boats from time to time, and boats are great in some of these lakes where you've got not a lot of shallow shorelines to fish, and particularly in lakes and ponds where you've got flats out in the middle of the lake where the carp can get up to, boats can be highly effective, and a lot of guys have set up and rigged their boats much like the flats boats that you'd see down in the saltwater to chase these things around, and it's a great way. It's probably more effective than shore fishing for them.
Yeah, I know Mark Bonham up in Wyoming, who, guides and has a shop there in the Great Reef area. But he goes out and hits the flats with his flats boat.
It gives
and,
you.
He's got a flats boat, yeah. That he.
Yeah, it gives you better visibility, a stealthier approach, because, again, the lateral line in the inner ear on the carp is highly developed. They're very sensitive, and they spook very easily. So anything that would give you an advantage such as that is a tool that's worth taking advantage of. And, the guys fishing out of boats do very, very well with them. It's just a lot of the areas I fish are small enough that I can fish it better and more effectively from shoreline, just being aware that I need to be quiet and not spook the fish and not make too much noise as I walk along the shoreline. But I don't get out in the water that much and chase them. I'm usually fishing from the shore, and I'm usually staying, 5 or 10 feet back from the shoreline as I try and approach these fish. So I try and offset not being in a boat by keeping my distance from the fish and keeping a noise to the minimum. There's a shot in the DVD Urban Warfare where I sit there and I sneak up on a fish and I hit a tree branch and blow the whole school out of there. And then I take and throw my rod about 20 feet, so it can get frustrating.
Well, that's a question just came in on the Internet. Dale in Durham, North Carolina, he says, I often see carp so shallow that their backs are out of the water, but I always spook them. Do you have any advice for super shallow fish? Are you crawling around out there, Barry, in your hands?
Yes, we are.
Okay.
The first words out of my mouth are going to be to get down on your knees and crawl. It can be that sneaky of an approach that makes the difference between spooking them and getting a shot to get the fly in front of them. They are very spooky, particularly when they're in that shallow water that he's talking about. They're very hard to approach. And again, I may stay 20 or 30 feet back on the shore, off the shoreline, and cast that far to try and present the fly to these fish, because I know that if I get much closer, I'm going to spook one. If I spook one, I'm going to spook the whole group out of there.
How long does it take for them to come back to an area like Moore? Is it not worth the wait?
In all honesty, they may never come back until the next day or that evening. I mean, literally hours. But that's not to say a fresh group isn't going to move in. But the fish you spook, chances are they're going to be gone for quite a while.
Yeah. We had another question, Andy Cordova. I know Andy listens to our show a lot. He's in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And you were just fishing down there, you said, for tiger muskie near Albuquerque.
Yep.
He said he's tried fishing for carp several times in some irrigation ditches. I know there are carp in them, but most of the time the water's too murky to see them, and not knowing how deep the ditches are, I don't know what approach to take. And I'm guessing he's talking about kind of those slow-moving irrigation ditches where there's just a a tad of current going through there. How would you approach that kind of water?
Again, my recommendation would be is to walk the shoreline and look for tails. And when I say tails, I'm not talking about tails that anybody could see. I'm talking about tails that are going to be just slightly below the surface. Because I have a couple areas here that we fish that are very similar to that. And when the water's off color, the only thing that we can ever pick out is the orange of their fins. And that's what we're looking for.
And he's talking about a deep, you know, deeper ditches, I think, where, and the, you know, most of those don't even have any shallow at all, though. So are they down in the 3-4 feet deep in these ditches? Is that where they're sitting most of the time?
Exactly. But again, if they're feeding actively, they're going to tilt their nose and their tail is going to come up towards the surface. And usually there's enough coloration in the tails on these fish that we can pick them out even in the dirtiest of water. But if it's much deeper than that, again, you're fairly limited in what you can do, so you're going to have to look for these fish as they move or very close to that shoreline, even if it is a ditch where they move up on it. There's, like I said, there's a couple ditches that I fish that are very similar to that, and the only fish that we are catching out of those ditches are the ones that have moved up real tight to the edge. And again, it's still over, like you said, 3 or 4 feet of water, but they're there. We're just looking for the tails.
Okay. One final question here about when you do hook up, are there any special techniques you use for setting the hook differently and or fighting the fish differently than you would other fish?
Yes and yes. As far as the hook set goes with these fish, it's amazing how much people underestimate the power of these fish. So I see all these different types of hook sets. I refer to them as the Jimmy Houston hook set, where they're trying to, you know, jerk the fish completely
out of into the boat, right?
Exactly. And what I like to do is use it's a slip strike. So if I have my rod tip pointing directly down at the water level or into the water, as I feel or detect the fish there, as I raise my rod tip, I let a little bit of slack line slide through my finger. And just before that rod tip gets to the highest point, I pinch that line off and just give them a little poke. And they usually do the rest for you as far as setting the hook. But if you sit there and clamp down on them right away, that fish is going to turn and take off, and more times than not, he's going to pop you off before you even get a chance to raise the rod tip. So you got to be willing to give them a little line in the beginning. And like I said, so I like to use a strip strike when I set the hook on these fish. That's easier said than done because we all get excited when we fill a fish on. And I still break my share off in that first initial surge when that fish fills that hook point and turns around and takes off for parts unknown. So that's the best way to protect, particularly when you're using lighter tippet. Again, when we get up and we're using 8 and 10-pound test in dirty water situations, I can usually, you know, put the hammer to them and not have to worry about popping my tippet off too much. But those are rare occasions, and more times than not, you're going to need to use lighter tippet and use that slip strike on them and protect your light tippet. As far as fighting the fish, there's definitely things you can do using lighter rods to handle these bigger fish. And the one thing that carp hates more than anything is for you to take and turn his nose and point it to the bottom. So I use a lot of side angle and downward pressure with the rod to turn these fish instead of trying to use the strength of the rod or the butt of the rod to turn these fish. Don't fight these fish with a high rod tip. Clear the line, let them make their initial run with the rod tip high because you want to keep the line as clear of things in the water as possible. But once you get into fighting the fish itself, I use a lot of side pressure and a lot of downward angle on the rod to turn these fish, particularly after they've made their first initial run. Then it's time for me to take over and use that rod against them. And they do not like their nose or their mouth or being pulled towards the bottom. So that side pressure there, or that side downward pressure, puts them in that predicament, and they don't like it, and they'll immediately turn and swim towards you instead of away from you.
sounds almost like fighting a fish in the salt.
Yep.
Kind of fighting techniques, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. But that will allow you to handle the biggest of these fish, even with lighter rods. And like I said, they do not like their nose being pointed or pulled down. And if you can apply that kind of pressure to them, and I did that with that 36-pounder I got earlier this year, because that fish, after its initial run, had me 150 yards into my backing. And once I got that fish back to me and it decided it wanted to take off again, I'd let it run about 10 feet and then just roll that rod tip down and put the side downward pressure on it. And every single time, Roger, that fish would turn and come back to me.
Good tip, good tip. Well, good advice to finish things up with here, Barry. We're out of time, so we got to wrap it up, but stick around here with me for a few more minutes. We're going to give away some prizes and ask some questions, see if people learned anything here tonight. So, and we'll be doing the drawing for the Federation of Fly Fishers, a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine, and a $28 gift certificate to Front Range Anglers. So stay tuned, folks, to see if you win. A mining company called Pac Rim Coal is planning a massive strip mine near Anchorage, Alaska. The Chewitna Coal Project would be the first project in Alaska history to mine directly through salmon habitat, the Chewitna River drainage, 11 miles of it. Critical commercial sport and subsistence fishing economies would be permanently destroyed. Pac Rim says they can rebuild a salmon stream, but scientific experts can find no example where successful restoration has occurred after strip mining. Chewitna coal would be shipped to Asia, leaving Alaska with nothing but devastated habitat and ruined salmon runs. It's time to stop the Chewitna coal strip mine. For more information about how you can help, visit www.inletkeeper.org, inletkeeper.org, or www.trustees.org, trustees.org. So if you're interested, help the folks out. Just a quick reminder to everyone before you leave the website tonight, take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section on tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on that link and leave us your comments. We'd really appreciate it. And now it's time to give away our prizes. So the winners from our drawings are randomly selected from our show's registration database. If you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late now, but make sure you do so for our next show, as you don't want to miss out on any chance to win some of these incredible prizes that we do give away. If you are the lucky winner tonight for one of these drawings, we will contact you after the show and get your information from you so that we can get these prizes to you. Now, the first thing we're going to give away is that three-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, and what a great organization to support and also to be part of. If you want to know more about the Federation of Fly Fishers, go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org. So let's get our winner for that three-year membership, and that's going to be Robert Butcher. Robert Butcher. So congratulations, Robert. Robert's up in Idaho, and I'm sure you'll enjoy your membership. And if you already have one, we'll get it extended for you as well. Now that one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine, which is a magazine out of Calgary, Canada, to learn more about Fly Fusion, go to flyfusionmag.com, flyfusionmag.com. Wonderful, beautiful magazine that has a lot of how-to type articles in it, so I know you'll enjoy that as well. And our winner there is William Corder in Georgia. William Corder in Georgia. So congratulations, William, on winning that. Well, now our final gift that we're going to give away tonight is a $20 gift certificate courtesy of Front Range Anglers in Boulder, Colorado. Their website is frontrangeanglers.com, so if you are the lucky person to get the answer to the question right tonight, you can redeem that online or in their store. Either way will work. Now, the question is, and I'll take one of two answers on this. One of two answers. And the question is, Barry mentioned two colors that he liked for his flies. There were two different colors that he liked. What colors are those? And you need to be specific. What colors are those? Give me one of them, and you'll get the $20 gift certificate. So we'll see what they come up with, Barry. I don't know. Let's see. Nope, that's not what I was looking for. We got one answer here, olive woolly booger. But no, he had mentioned two colors together when he was talking about colors that he liked for flies for carp. Nope, yellow's not it. Uh-oh, I think this might be one of them, Barry. How about burnt orange?
That'll work.
That'll work. Okay. Well, that's Scott Higashi in Rockland, California. Scott, you just got a $20 gift certificate. So, congratulations. Scott, send me your contact information either via the text box you just used or to info@askaboutflyfishing.com. I'll need your name, your address, your phone number, your email address, and we'll get that $20 gift certificate out to you. So congratulations, all who participated tonight, and be sure everybody to be with us next time, and maybe you'll be a winner. Well, Barry, hey, it's been a great pleasure again to talk with you and learn about carp and their habits, and surely enjoyed it. And thanks for taking time to share your experiences.
Yeah, it was my pleasure to be there, and thanks for having me.
Well, we'll have to do it again sometime. Hopefully it'll be some new species that you've targeted and got your attention.
We'll see what we can figure. I think snapping turtles is the next one.
Snapping turtles, there we go. Now, I know there won't be a lot of experience, so there'll be a lot to teach about that. So. Well, our next broadcast will be on October 7th, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern. On that show, we're going to be interviewing Pat Dorsey, and Pat Dorsey is going to talk to us about fly fishing tailwaters. Fly fishing tailwaters. So you'll learn all his techniques and strategies, nymphing, dry fly fishing, and streamer fishing for tailwater fisheries. So be sure to join us for that show. And we'd like to thank Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Royal Gorge Anglers, Keeney's Fly Shop, Power Fibers Online Magazine for sponsoring our show tonight. Think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows? Give us a call at 1-888-961-1115 extension 2. That's 888-961-1115 extension 2. And we'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.